This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Jonathan Rosenblum. Jonathan has been a labor organizer for more than 30 years, playing key roles, including SeaTac Airport Campaign Director. He is a contributor to publications such as These Times and Yes Magazine. Jonathan Rosenblum is here to tell us about his book, Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement, published in 2017. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Diane. Good to be on.
Why did you write Beyond 15? What is your purpose?
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, I've been a union and community organizer for most of my adult life. And between 2011 and 2014, I was fortunate to be the campaign director of a campaign that was transformational in so many different ways, the SeaTac Airport Workers Campaign that culminated in the successful $15 ballot initiative in the city of SeaTac. And after I had a chance to step back from that campaign, I realized that what we had all been through, the organizers, the community members, the workers, was a tremendous experience, a learning experience about how working people can build power in society today. And I realized that if no one stopped to sit down and write about what we went through, then the lessons would really evaporate into history. And so I stopped doing the organizing work, and I went back and talked to the airport workers and the activists and the clergy in the community and asked them about their perspectives on the campaign, what they learned, and that's turned into this book.
Would you just very briefly remind us of the story of the SeaTac initiative to raise the minimum wage to $15?
Absolutely. Well, beginning in 2011, SeaTac airport workers began to organize around the banner of making every airport job a good job. By 2011, airlines and other businesses around the airport had successfully refashioned what used to be living wage jobs into poverty wage jobs. And there were, at the time, 4,000 jobs that were paying minimum wage or close to minimum wage at the airport. These are baggage handlers, cabin cleaners, fuelers, wheelchair attendants, and the like. And my union at the time, SEIU, and the Teamsters and other unions and community organizations came together with the workers, with the community, and built an organizing campaign, workers standing up and demanding union rights. And as part of that campaign, we launched the initiative that became known as the $15 Initiative. And in a very tightly fought battle, where we were opposed by Alaska Airlines, the Chamber of Commerce, and all other big businesses in the area, SeaTac workers prevailed in the fall of 2013 and won the first ballot initiative for $15 in the country. And today, workers who back in 2011 were making minimum wage around $9 an hour, today those same workers are making over $15 an hour. They have health care, they have job security, they have benefits.
How have conditions for airport workers in the U.S. changed since the mid-20th century overall?
Well, big changes really began to happen in the late 1970s. And a pivotal year actually was 1978. When a Democratic-led Congress and President Carter passed laws and then Carter signed into law the Airline Deregulation Act. And what this did is this essentially created incentives for airlines to break unions, to get out of their pension obligations, to contract out work, and to take what were good middle-income jobs in the community down to minimum wage jobs. And over the course of the decade or decade and a half that followed, that's what happened to thousands and thousands of jobs around the country, of course, not just in SeaTac, but at airports around the country. And then following 9/11, airlines doubled down on the union busting and lowering working conditions using bankruptcy laws that had also been passed in 1978 that allowed them to get out of their pension obligations, that allowed them to break union contracts. And in fact, in SeaTac, a lot of this union busting was later than at other airports. But in 2005, there was a huge shift when Alaska Airlines fired nearly 500 baggage handlers and converted those good living wage jobs into minimum wage jobs.
Why did unions fail to prevent the decline in conditions?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's the complicated question. I think many unions and certainly many union members saw all along that the changes that were going on in the industry required workers to stand up and to fight back. But unfortunately, there were also a number of people in unions and in public policy who didn't see what was happening and thought that they could manage the changes. But in fact, I think it's very clear in retrospect. You look at what happened through the 1970s with the legislative change building up to 1978 and the years after that. Corporate America had a clear plan of what they wanted the airport economy to look like, and they drove directly toward that. Union members, many union members certainly saw the dangers, but sometimes we only saw them too late. And when the organizing really took off in 2011, there were a number of workers who had been around back when the jobs were good jobs, and they remembered very different conditions and very different relationships with the airlines, and that's what they aimed to restore.
Overall, how were workers treated by employers at SeaTac Airport prior to the campaign for a $15 minimum wage?
Well, when the organizers first began talking with workers in significant numbers in 2011, what we found is, first of all, it was largely immigrant workforce, people from East Africa, the Ukraine, Asian Pacific Islanders, people from Latin America, and so on. And what they told us is that not only were the wages bad, but they didn't know sometimes from day to day what their work hours would be like. They had no benefits to speak of. They were treated rudely by supervisors, abused in front of airline passengers. And oftentimes people got fired for even the smallest of things. There's a story that one of the pastors who's important in my book, Reverend Jan Bolerjack, tells of having a volunteer in her church's food pantry who comes every week to help out distribute the food to people who need it. And one day she found him not handing out the food, but on the receiving end to receive food. And she asked him what happened. And he said, well, he had just gotten fired. It turns out he had a child who had a disability and needed some medical care. His wife was unable to take the child to the doctor. So he did. He missed a day of work and the company fired him. Now, people like that, what they end up doing is they often just go to another contractor at the airport, get hired on, and they cycle through these jobs again and again, never able to achieve any form of economic security.
Why did you decide to put forward an initiative to raise the minimum wage to $15? Why this particular approach?
Well, we didn't start off with $15, and we really have to give credit to the fast food workers in New York City who in late 2012 first raised the banner demanding $15 and a union. But as we went through 2012 and the campaign was building momentum in the community, we realized that we had to figure out how to place demands before Alaska Airlines, the main airline at the airport, and other employers. And workers actually helped develop this idea that what we had to do first was demand union recognition from the employers. And so in March of 2013, about 80 workers and clergy and community allies went from one contractor management office to another, leaving petitions saying, we formed unions, we have majority status at your contractor, and we call on you to sit down and negotiate with us. And the delegation also went to Alaska Airlines, where we said to management there, you have the power over these contractors because you're the ones who hire them. So you should tell them that they should sit down and negotiate with us. Every single contractor refused, and Alaska Airlines refused as well. And so having been refused, we could say, well, if you won't negotiate with us, we will go to the voters and have them impose a solution on you. And that's exactly what happened.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jonathan Rosenblum, author of the book Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. How did the campaign for a $15 minimum wage at SeaTac differ from the traditional union organizing?
Well, that's a great question, Diane. I think it differed in many ways, but let's just step back from the particulars of the strategies and tactics and say that there was a recognition in the campaign by the workers and by the community members that we weren't just fighting to increase the wages or get benefits. We were fighting to change the power dynamic at the airport, that what had happened beginning in 1978 with airline deregulation and the bankruptcy laws was a tilting of power away from workers and communities and toward employers, toward corporate America, and that this was an effort to take power back. So the initiative became a way, especially once the employers all refused to sit down and negotiate, the initiative became a way for workers to express their power and to say, if you won't give us what we need directly, then we'll go to the voters. And what followed really was a power struggle within the community, where you have on the one side airport workers, their family members, community members, ministers, imams, rabbis, others, all lined up to support the initiative and to support the fight. And then on the other side, you had Alaska Airlines, the major hotels, the local Chamber of Commerce, the Seattle Times editorial board, all of the representatives of big business and their supporters in the media who said, this is a bad idea. This is terrible. This is going to destroy business. The Seattle Times editorial board wrote that this is a virtual union contract, and I couldn't disagree with that.
In your book, you point out that the campaign for 15 was about more than just a wage increase. Would you explain?
There's so many ways to talk about this. Let me think of a good example. So after the workers went with the community to demand union recognition, of course, the employers said no. We fully expected that. But what workers said is it's interesting. They came back into the workplace and they found that their supervisors were a little bit more tempered in their interactions, that they didn't heap abuse on the workers anymore, that they seemed nervous, and some of them seemed even scared to take on the workers. And what workers got there was a sense of empowerment, that they had changed the dynamic of the culture within the airport, and they were beginning to realize their human dignity. After the initiative passed, we went back, a number of us went back, and then I interviewed people and asked them what difference $15 made. And so there's a wheelchair attendant who was a pharmacist in his home country and working 80 hours a week at the airport just to make enough food to pay the rent and take care of his baby. Well, now he can reduce hours and go back to nursing school. We have workers who've been able to buy homes, been able to go back to school, been able to send money to relatives, go out to eat once a month, those sorts of things. And so it's more than just $15, Diane. It's about people reclaiming their human dignity.
What approach to coalition building did you take in the campaign for a $15 minimum wage?
One thing that we did in approaching the community was those of us who are union organizers said we have some expertise and we think we have some good ideas, but we don't have all the good ideas. And so we have to partner with the community. And that meant not just asking the clergy to come to a press conference and speak on behalf of the workers because they had moral authority, but it meant inviting those same people into our strategic discussions and saying to them, we want you to actually help shape the direction of this campaign. I think all too often unions in the recent past have seen community allies more in a utilitarian sort of way, that we call upon you when we need you, instead of inviting people in from the community as co-partners in building this justice campaign. And I think that was really important, especially when I went back and talked to people in the community after the campaign. Time and again, I heard how people felt invested in it because they were asked to bring their ideas, not just their voice or their moral authority.
Say more about how you went about reaching out to immigrant and refugee communities.
Well, for one thing, the union, and this was before I started on the campaign, but the union made a very good decision to hire people from the community so that there was language and cultural competency. By the time I began working on it, we had organizers from several different countries participating in the work. Those organizers helped to build this campaign by reminding all of us on the campaign that we couldn't just work on the issues of wages, hours, and working conditions for airport workers. We also had to address concerns that the community raised up as a whole. And so, for instance, in 2011, when Hertz Rent-A-Car suspended workers, Muslim workers, for taking breaks to pray, where they had never had a problem allowing workers to take prayer breaks before, the movement gathered around these workers and supported them and held an interfaith demonstration and prayer vigil outside the Hertz management office. And what happened after that is the workers went back to all their mosques and their community organizations, and they said, this is what's happened, that the union's actually standing up for our right to pray as well, not just about improving our wages. And that was, I think, the beginning of a turning, a beginning of trust building between the community, especially the Muslim community and the union, where we in the union recognized we've got to address faith issues because faith issues are central to the workers at the airport. And the Muslim community recognized we've got to join in with this union because this union is about economic justice, and economic justice is about lifting up our community as well. And together, we built a powerful movement.
To what extent did other communities of faith contribute to the coalition?
Well, Christian clergy were vital to the campaign. And I remember having one discussion with a number of clergy before the 2013 Alaska Airlines shareholders meeting. And we were prepared to go in and bring our demands into the meeting. And they said, why don't we start with a prayer for justice? And one of the clergy put together a prayer. And when the meeting was about to begin, we were all in this shareholders meeting hall, 200 people, the CEO was there, all the board of directors, and about 80 of us who bought shares or had been given proxies so we could get in, who were airport workers and other activists. And about a dozen clergy just filed up to the front of the room. And being clergy, they had the moral authority to take over the room. And the leader, John Helmier, Reverend John Helmier, from Valley and Mountain Fellowship here in South Seattle, said, I'd like to start with a prayer. And it drew people in. He said, let us, let's pray for success and let's honor the workers and the community who make this company successful. And it was an act of rebellion. And at the same time, it framed the campaign in a moral framework that just gave confidence to everybody else in the room to speak up and to yell and to chant and to sing later on. And it was also a moral challenge to the company that they really couldn't respond to effectively. So that's an example of how the faith community really played a vital role in the campaign's overall success.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jonathan Rosenblum, author of the book Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. In your view, what was most responsible for your success in the SeaTac campaign?
Well, a lot of things were responsible, of course, for the success, but the most important thing I would say is, the three most important things. One is that the campaign was clearly framed around the issue of power, that this wasn't just about winning a wage or winning union recognition at one place, but it was about tilting power toward workers in the community and away from the corporations that ran the airport. The second thing, Diane, that was important was this notion of a different kind of a labor movement that we were forming, which was not just my union, SEIU, and the Teamsters and other great unions, but it was about the community as well. And it was about how we organized ourselves, how we strategized, and how we acted together as one union in the workplace and in the community. And the third thing that I think is vital is that we really embraced the wisdom and the ideas of workers and community members, ordinary activists who were not professional organizers, but who had ideas and insights that were vital to putting together a winning strategy.
And to what extent was this different from what you call the business union model?
Well, too often in many unions today, unfortunately, workers come to see the union as an insurance policy, not as a vehicle for social transformation. And a big part of this is how unions formed themselves, largely in the post-World War II era, where they became these business unions designed to serve the needs of members, administer the contract, file grievances on their behalf, and rather than be agents of their own empowerment, union members became recipients of services. And unwinding this business union mentality, this culture, is something that has never been more urgent than today.
In your view, what is the status of the labor movement overall in the U.S.?
I think most of your listeners would agree that we're really at an existential crisis in today's political world. I see the landscape as being incredibly volatile, that we have simultaneously huge danger, but also great opportunity. On the one hand, we have Donald Trump and his xenophobia, Islamophobia, racism, sexism, and his long record of exploiting workers, his disregard for the safety of our planet, and so on. But on the other hand, his ascension to power has summoned into being this amazing, budding resistance movement that's really challenged all of us to think about how do we unite, how do we act bolder, and how do we stand together and put forward a different vision for this country.
And how do you see a reimagined labor movement? How would it be different?
A different labor movement, a revitalized labor movement, is a movement that can put forward a vision for this country that is not just about the next fight that we have to save affordable health care or to win raises, but has a true vision of a socially and economically just country. The second component of a vital labor movement is a movement that sees itself as not just workplace unions. I talk in the book about community organizations and how they often are seen as different from unions. They're brought in to help out on campaigns only as needed. We really need to look at groups in the community as unions in the community, just like you have unions in the workplace. So groups that are fighting for the rights of people who use public transportation, anti-foreclosure groups, worker centers, women's rights groups, immigrant rights groups, and so on. These are all forms of unions as well. And we really need to see the labor movement as something that embraces unions in the community as well as unions in the workplace. And finally, a new labor movement really has to embrace authentically the contributions of ordinary workers, their wisdom and insights as we put our plans together to lead major campaigns. I don't believe that the campaigns can only be conceived in think tanks and strategic rooms of union halls or in self-appointed innovation centers, but rather they have to be developed through a dynamic where we bring in professional expertise and combine it with the expertise that's at the grassroots level. And together, that's what produces a winning plan.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I hope my book is, in its own modest way, a contribution to the important and vital debate we have today about the future of the labor movement, the future of workers in this economy, and how we can build power for working people and take power back from corporate America, the 1%.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message, I would say, is when we fight, we can win. And I want to just bring out, there's a worker, Habiba Ali. She's a wheelchair attendant. And she was making minimum wage when she arrived here in 2011 at the airport. And she went through the ups and downs of the campaign where we won the initiative. And then it looked like there might be a recount or it might be too close to call. And then we finally were declared the victors. Then she and her coworkers went on to form a union at their company, Bags. Bags Incorporated was the name of the wheelchair company that employed her. And when she and her coworkers went to Bags to demand union recognition in early 2014, the manager locked the door on them and forced them to go through litigation to even get an election. And they finally won the election. But during that time, Alaska Airlines had successfully convinced a court to hold up the $15 initiative, even though the voters had approved it. And it took a couple of years for that to get resolved. But finally, In early 2016, Habiba and her coworkers went to their management offices to claim not just their $15 because the litigation had been settled, but the back wages that Bags owed them. And she got a check for almost $7,000, and others got checks for even more money than that. And what she said to me afterwards, she said, "Now I believe we can do anything."
Well, thanks so much for being here, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
You are just listening to Jonathan Rosenblum, author of the book Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement, published in 2017 by Beacon Press. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Power at 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.